Freddie Hubbard on trumpet opening I Heard That with the Paul Chambers Quintet, featuring Cannonball Adderley on alto sax, Wynton Kelly on piano, Jimmy Cobb on drums, and the revered Paul Chambers himself on bass. It's from Chambers' 1959 album titled Go. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And today, I think I misspoke yesterday when I said that Gerald Horn was going to join us Thursday. I meant to say today. And indeed, he is with us today. This year's presidential election, we're constantly told, is and ever will be historic. Thinking minds immediately should erect their best defenses, for U.S. history has a peculiar history. It almost never tells the whole story, and its chief purpose is to secure and undergird the interests of the power elite. The historicity of the political moment would suffer a similar fate were it not for scholars such as today's guest, Dr. Gerald Horn, who boldly have been waging their own struggles against long-standing proscriptions against telling the whole story, lest America's true nature be accurately documented and widely known. Gerald Horn, the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, and prolific author of more than 30 books and 100 scholarly papers on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism, regularly decodes for us complex social, political, and economic issues right here on Lead Stories. But today's program is different, I think, in that he is going to be giving us an assessment from a radical point of view of election 2016 and from the vantage point of two incredibly vistas, if you will, as a historian and as a former contender himself. He was a candidate for office. So we'll talk about these two things. Dr. Horn's books we have discussed here, they are extraordinary, and I recommend them highly to you. The most recent have been The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, that was published in 2014, Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, also 2014, Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, that was published last year, and most recently, Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. And these are just a few of the titles that have earned Dr. Gerald Horn a very, very respected place as a historian and as a scholar. And I thank you, Gerald, for being with us. You're always so kind to make yourself available in these times when we really need some serious decoding. You're right there. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's start about this business of the historicity of the moment. I'm talking straight to your acumen as a historian. What for you emerges as the significant aspects of 2016's election, presidential election, from a historian's point of view?
Well, what leaps into my mind initially is 1964. In 1964, recall that Lyndon Baines Johnson, recently elevated to the White House because of the murder and assassination of John F. Kennedy, was running for election against Barry Goldwater, the conservative Republican from Arizona. And quite understandably, and not without justification, the Democrats portrayed Barry Goldwater as being rather erratic, that you would not want his finger on the nuclear button, that he was not sympathetic, to put it mildly, to civil rights. And as a direct result, Barry Goldwater lost in the landslide election, with only Dixie voting in his favor. But once Johnson was elected, he, of course, escalated the war in Vietnam, and he set the stage for the election of Richard M. Nixon in 1968. History, as is often said, does not necessarily repeat itself, but is also often said it does rhyme from time to time. And what concerns me right now is a replay of 1964 and 2016. That is to say that I'm very much concerned with the fact that Republican hawks and neocons are defecting to the column of Hillary Rodham Clinton. And given the fact that a good deal of the base of the Democratic Party is really not up to speed on foreign policy, I'm speaking quite frankly of the labor movement in the first place, and the Black American electorate in the second place. And as a result, it becomes very difficult for those two constituencies to articulate a message, a consistent anti-war message in particular. And this is taking place in the context of rather loose talk, believe it or not, about war with Russia and or China. It's almost a predictable, inevitable outcome that if Hillary Rodham Clinton is elected, there will be an escalation in Syria. She's taken a position to the right of President Obama on Syria, just like she was the driving force behind the intervention in Libya. And I understand why there's this concern about the elevation of Donald J. Trump to the White House. I mean, but let me point out in this context that I would like to salute The Nation, the magazine published in New York, a weekly publication, which also is anti-Trump, but had a very striking editorial just a few days ago reprimanding the Democrats at their convention for the Moscow bashing, this whole idea that Moscow is behind the leaks of the Democratic National Committee emails that showed a campaign against Bernie Sanders. Of course, the focus on Moscow took attention away from the focus on the sandbagging of Bernie Sanders. And in any case, it's not really clear if Moscow was really behind this. But in any case, The Nation then reprimanded Paul Krugman of the New York Times for terming Donald J. Trump the Siberian candidate, that he's some sort of agent of Vladimir Putin, the ogre of the day. And I think The Nation was pointing out that even as we seek to defeat Trump, we shouldn't be giving away the ball game to the ultra-right hawks, because otherwise we'll find ourselves in the same position that progressive forces found themselves in 1965. That is to say, putting their shoulder to the wheel to elect Lyndon Baines Johnson, but not paying sufficient attention to the correlation of forces, which is the ultimate determinant of politics, and thereby helping to energize and empower our hawks and neocons, who then began to crusade successfully for raining bombs down on Vietnam. I would hope that that particular scenario is not repeated in 2017.
Yes, I'm sorry. You place this squarely within the duopoly, the Republicans and the Democrats. But isn't there an interesting historical development here with the advent of the powerful, I would think, influence of the Bernie Sanders movement and independent politics, as such as in the Green Party?
Well, that's a friendly amendment that I willingly and eagerly accept. I think as well that attention needs to be paid to a strategy put forward by a certain leading Greens. I'm not sure if it's the position of the party as a whole, that in light of the N-word, I'm speaking of Ralph Nader, and this attempt to place the victory of George W. Bush in 2000, on his narrow shoulders, as opposed to Gore not winning Tennessee, his home state, as opposed to Gore selecting a certified neocon, Joe Lieberman, as his VP candidate, which turned off many voters. And despite the fact that Gore actually got more votes, but it's the antiquated, archaic Electoral College that led to the elevation of George W. Bush, along with the friendly assistance of the U.S. Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia, in the first place. But in any case, even our friends on the left have helped to construct this narrative that there should be no third parties, because it inevitably leads on the presidential level to the election of the greater evil. So certain leading Greens have taken note of that particular idea, whether or not it has merit as a secondary question at this point. And they have said, okay, we have an electoral college in the United States of America. That means that there is not a single election. There is 51 different elections, 50 states in the District of Columbia, that you can get the most votes and still lose, as Al Gore can tell you. We already know in advance, because of political polarization, who is going to prevail in most states. You might have noticed that both Trump and Pence, not to mention Clinton and Kaine, repeatedly campaigned in Florida, in North Carolina, in Ohio. You should not see that as an accident or a coincidence. It is doubtful if 40-plus states will get a presidential visit before the first Tuesday in November, because we already know what the result is going to be. We already know, unless some miracle happens, and I tend to doubt it, that in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama, 80 to 90% of Euro-Americans will vote for the right. Now, of course, as a footnote, some of our friends on the left who have become apologists for retrograde tendencies in the white working class have put forward this idea that since a supposed typical Trump voter has an income of $72,000, that means that the white working class is not culpable with regard to the rise of Trump. It's the petty bourgeoisie, we're told, even though we know that there are police officers working overtime who make that much, or longshoremen, or certain teachers, or certain long-haul truck drivers, etc. But that's another discussion for another day. And so we already know that hell will freeze over before the Democrats win the presidential election in certain states in Dixie. So why not vote for a Green, because we know that the Democrats have proven themselves incapable of bringing the right wing to heel in those states. We obviously need another way. We obviously can't keep doing the same thing every 4 years and expect a different result. So they put forward what they call a safe state strategy, which is vote for third parties, particularly parties of the left, in those 40-plus states where we know what the result is going to be in advance. And I think it would be very important, and perhaps even restraining for the hawks and neocons who are backing Hillary Clinton, if in November 2016 they see hundreds of thousands of millions, not millions of votes, for left-wing parties. That will tell them that they're in for a struggle when they seek to take money from the mouths of babes and shovel it into the mouths of the Pentagon. So you are correct to point to the Green alternative, and I would also say other left-wing alternatives as well in those 40-plus states where we already know the result in advance.
But does the Green Party, in your view, although it presents a reasonable alternative, and we've been talking about that, does it have the capacity to deliver on the very ambitious platform that it has enunciated?
Well, it would have to take over the reins of power and take control of the federal treasury in order to deliver on all of its promises. That's point number one. But point number two, I think it's fair to say that we in the United States have dug a deep hole for ourselves over recent years and decades. I mean, for example, as opposed to making excuses for those white working class people who are casting a lever for Trump, casting a vote for Trump, pulling the lever for Trump, we should try to explain it, because if we don't explain it, we can't diagnose it. And if we can't diagnose it, we can't put forward a remedy. So we don't need apologies. We need explanations. And I think that one of the reasons that trade has become a third rail in U.S. politics, and with this massive opposition to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership in particular, is because many recognize that what the U.S. ruling elite has done is use trade agreements to whipsaw the U.S. working class. That is to say, to use trade agreements to facilitate their moving jobs abroad to low-wage havens and taking jobs from the United States of America. That's really what the trade argument is all about. And the New York Times editorial a few days ago, perhaps not accidentally, wholly missed that point. And what the left should be able to tell this segment of the working class is that the reason in part that those trade deals were negotiated was not only because of profit, it was also because of larger strategic ambitions of U.S. imperialism. That is to say that when China was admitted to the World Trade Organization, and when the United States, even before that, years before that, negotiated an entente with China during the administration of Richard M. Nixon for some four odd decades ago, this was part of a larger geopolitical scheme to bring Moscow to heel. And there had to be a payoff. And the payoff was that massive direct foreign investment into China. And that's what has helped to create this world today, which now Gideon Rockman, the Financial Times columnist in his new book called Easternization, as opposed to Westernization, by the way, talks about this historic millennial shift of power and influence from the North Atlantic to Asia, and particularly China. This did not happen by accident. This happened as a direct result of the misfiring of U.S. imperialism's geopolitical ambitions. And likewise, with regard to all of this talk about, quote, terrorism, in fact, we know that this phenomenon became turbocharged in the 1980s, particularly in the 1970s, when under U.S. President Jimmy Carter, there was an attempt to destabilize a left-leaning regime in Kabul, Afghanistan, that was backed by Moscow. And in order to do that, the United States entered into a marriage of convenience with religious zealots. That's where Al-Qaeda was born. And that from that point, you had a destabilization of progressive left-leaning Muslims. I mean, you may know in the 1970s and 1980s, you had communist-leaning forces, not only in Afghanistan, but in Iraq, in Syria, etc. But those forces had to go because they were seen as too pro-Moscow. And as a result, they were replaced by these religious zealots that the United States is now trying to wage war against. At least this is what we're told. And so you have this inevitable endless war where the United States helps to create situations and then wages war against that situation. They help to oust the left from Kabul, Afghanistan, and help to boost into power religious zealots. Now they're waging wars against the religious zealots. This, of course, benefits the military-industrial complex. I can't say that it benefits the U.S. working class, which brings me to my point that rather than making apologies for how some of the U.S. working class are supporting Trump, we should try to explain what has happened. But see, the problem is that many of our friends on the left were actually on board, believe it or not. Young people might find this hard to believe. We're actually on board when it came to the destabilization campaign in Kabul, Afghanistan in the 1980s. They were supportive of the entente with China that led to the destabilization of Moscow. So therefore, they can't come forward and put forward an explanation for something that they helped engineer in part themselves. So this is the dilemma we face in 2016.
In fact, this was part of the question I was going to get to about the left having found itself, and this is part of the historic moment. This is a moment, really, for the left to look at the degree to which they have brought things to the point that we are. They have not; they do not have clean hands here. And is this a moment when, in fact, part of what could actually be a benefit in this moment is the left undertaking a serious self-audit and recommitting to some kind of a progressive agenda, because there are so many instances in which it contradicted itself and outright betrayed itself, cooperating with the other side. Is this a moment for you as a historian where the left seems to be, well, it's not coming out in the open to, commit acts of confession, but it doesn't seem like it's pausing, at least, to undertake an audit of itself, saying, to what degree are we responsible for this political quagmire?
Well, confession is good for the soul. At least that's what I've been told. But I wouldn't hold my breath for any kind of agonizing reappraisal or self-audit by many of our friends on the left. I mean, first of all, they would say that they're too busy trying to defeat Trump. And then, what's interesting is that if you look at the United States and the U.S. left in particular, in odd years, that is, say, 2009, 2011, 2013, 2015, we have this discourse about democracy and how the United States has this so-called revolutionary tradition and helped to pioneer in terms of bourgeois democratic rights and the right to vote, supposedly. Of course, we ignore the fact that the right to vote was limited to certain people, but that's another story for another day. But years of elections, 2008, 2010, 2012, 2014, 2016, there's a threat of fascism. So you have to sacrifice everything because fascism is on the horizon. Now, which is it? Do we have these strong and vibrant democratic traditions, or are we always on the verge of tipping into fascism? Well, quite frankly, I think if you were to make a choice between those two poles, I would say it's the latter. Because any country that tolerated slavery and Jim Crow for most of its history obviously has the seeds for a full, vibrant, and thriving fascism. And that's the kind of honesty that we need right now. And if you then begin to turn, as some of my history books have done, to how was it that we were able to defeat slavery and Jim Crow, we would easily and readily come to the conclusion is that it was because of an international movement. That is to say, the assistance of Haitian revolutionaries in the 19th century led to the general crisis of the slave system that led inevitably to the collapse of slavery, including in North America, that British abolitionists in particular put so much pressure on the U.S. authorities, that too helped to contribute to this general crisis of the slave system, that in the 20th century, it was the rise of a socialist camp, the rise of national liberation movements in Africa and the Caribbean, assisted by the socialist camp, that caused the U.S. authorities to make an agonizing retreat from Jim Crow. And I should say in this context that the white working class does have a beef. The problem is that they're not able to articulate it, and our friends on the left are not able to assist them in articulating it. What I mean is that it's clear that the United States began its history in 1776 as something of a refuge for men, in particular, of European descent. Now, George Carlin, the late comedian, said that they call it the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it. But the fact is that there were numerous cases of men of European descent, poor and straggling, crossing the Atlantic, gaining land taken from the Native Americans, stocked with enslaved Africans, and became wealthy and were able to live out the so-called American dream. I mean, that's just the reality. But because the left has bought into this romanticized notion of U.S. history, which sort of smooths out the ugly aspects, they can't point to that reality that I just sketched. And so, therefore, they're not able to explain and understand why it is that the United States had to move away from that egregious and obvious white supremacy to the more informal white supremacy we have today. That is to say that the United States had to move away from it because the international community had put so much pressure on the United States that it had to move away, and the United States had to change the rules of the game, and therefore, when people talk about making America great again, they can't come out and say that we want to go back to the time when there was egregious and obvious white supremacy. They'd have to leave it sort of vague, like Donald Trump left it sort of vague yesterday in North Carolina when he raised the flag about Hillary Rodham Clinton getting assassinated. You know, you have to leave these things vague. But everybody knows what's being said. And by making America great again, it's clear that they're talking about winding back the clock. But nobody comes out and really says it, and the left is not able to say that, you know what, the United States did have to change, but it had to change because there was international pressure. And it's going to be very difficult for the United States to wind back the clock. I guess the reason why many of the left don't say that, because perhaps they recognize in their heart of hearts that even though it may be difficult to wind back the clock, I'm afraid to say it's not impossible.
Well, this brings me to the question of the political positioning of the Green Party. It has been consistent since its formation in trying to communicate to the broader community that it is aware, it's doing the work of dismantling the symptoms, if you will, of our society, the apartheid society in which we live. They've had people of color integrated at high levels within the party. They have professed in their platforms concerns that take in a broad swath of the population, and they have done so with a very leftist point of view. However, we don't see a sense that they have maintained constant contact with these constituencies, and in a sense are behaving very much like the mainstream parties. You were an independent candidate. From the inside, as a person who has run for office, presumably under the auspices of an independent political system, what in this period of time, this political period, emerges for you as lessons learned or to be learned?
Well, just to put some flesh on the bones, in 1992, while I was living in the state of California, I ran for the U.S. Senate in the seat now held by Dianne Feinstein in her first successful race for the U.S. Senate on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket. And, of course, I used to be chairperson of the Peace and Freedom Party in the state of California, and got about 305,000 votes. By way of comparison, Jill Stein, if I'm not mistaken, when she ran for president in all 50 states in 2012, I think she may have got some 400,000 odd votes. So
she got 0.36% of the total vote in 2012.
And what was the total? Was it about 400-something thousand?
Yes.
Yeah. So it was not an... It was not an unsuccessful venture, but it was very illuminating. It's something that I look back on with pride, my association with the Peace and Freedom Party, because, not least because, when I was running for office, I found that people would come up to you and talk about everything. I mean, their personal problems, political problems. And it was, for me, speaking personally, it was an educational experience that has influenced me since then. Now, I have quite a bit of sympathy for the Greens and the dilemma that they face in this country built upon slavery and thievery of the land of Native Americans, and where it's very difficult to come face to face with that reality. And this is the constituencies that you oftentimes have to grapple with. It reminds me when I did this book on Hawaii, the Hawaiian labor movement. Hawaii, by the way, is the bluest of the blue states. It's a place where historically progressive sentiments have flourished, and that may not be separate from the fact that Hawaii, of course, is a so-called majority-minority state. The plurality of the population is of Japanese ancestry. The overwhelming majority is of Asian Pacific ancestry. And, of course, the so-called white population, or haole population, to use the Hawaiian term, is only about 15%. But one of the things I found is that point number one is that that Hawaiian configuration was largely the product of a left-wing union, a communist-led union, in fact, at the time, the International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union, led then by Harry Bridges, which, of course, engineered the San Francisco General Strike of 1934, and then moved westward to Hawaii, which then was like a feudal outcast of white supremacy, and turned that whole place around. It was a colony. It only became a state in 1959. And, of course, when it became a state, Dixie resisted Hawaii becoming a state because it felt, correctly, that Asian Pacific senators would push for civil rights legislation, which they, of course, did. But the reason I'm telling you this story is that even this progressive union, International Longshore and Warehouseman Union, which I take my hat off to, I salute them, they turned around a colony, turned an outpost of white supremacy into a progressive archipelago in a matter of 10 to 15 years. It really needs to be studied. And of course, you can study it by reading my book, Fighting in Paradise. But what strikes me about the union is that the Holly leadership of the union, the white leadership of the union, they always used to tell Japanese-American cadre that you have to take a step back to allow Filipino and Filipino-American leaders to step forward. They never talked about having Holly leaders take a step back or white leaders take a step back and let... in other words, even progressive forces were taking the position. If you're under the U.S. flag, white folks got to be in the driver's seat. They got to be in the lead. And these progressive people, these are, you know, stomping down anti-imperialists, Marxists, communists. So what that tells me is how deep and bone deep this white supremacy is in the United States of America. And this is what the Green Party is up against. So I'm sympathetic to them in their struggle because I guess they realize you got to start somewhere. And unless we're going to let these neocons and hawks plunge us into World War III, we got to start where we are and just start digging and start plunging ahead. And so I take my hat off to them, quite frankly.
But in what ways, in a pragmatic sense, in what ways can a Green Party or the Peace and Freedom Party or any other party achieve a departure from the mainstream when, in fact, it is playing by the mainstream's rules? Is there a different path that they could take, these movements that eventually, as we just saw, get co-opted, they get betrayed by like people like Sanders and what happened there. Jesse Jackson preceded that. We had the same thing with Dennis Kucinich. We had the same thing with Barack Obama, frankly. Utilizing the strength of the so-called vote, but playing by the same rules, only articulating different ideals, different ideas, but you don't see a different architecture, a different structure, a different approach.
Well, we must concede.
Why is that?
Well, we must concede that of those figures you named, Dennis Kucinich, Jesse Jackson, Bernie Sanders, Barack Obama, they were all running within the framework of the Democratic Party. And it used to be said by some of my friends on the left that the bosses have two parties, the Democrats and Republicans. The rest of us need at least one. And I think that what that sentiment was seeking to express is that the Democratic Party is comprised of various factions. And those factions include organized labor, AFL-CIO, Service Employees International Union, American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, United Auto Workers, United Steel Workers, et cetera, who supply much of the ground game and the foot soldiers for the Democratic Party. And then there's what former NAACP chairperson Margaret Bush Wilson used to call the big minority, that is to say, the black Americans in particular, who vote 90% plus for the Democrats, and then in descending order, you have Latinos and Asian Americans and Native Americans who vote in healthy majorities for the Democratic Party. But in the driver's seat, of course, is capital, particularly Wall Street, which does not necessarily employ organized labor, but also industries that do employ organized labor, such as the entertainment industry, Hollywood in the first place, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Steven Spielberg, David Geffen, formerly partners in DreamWorks, and of course still major players in that industry and still major players of the Democratic Party, they employ labor, but the labor they employ is usually corrupt labor. That is to say, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, IATSE, longtime connections to organized crime, ditto for the Teamsters. And the problem is that, A, capital is in the driver's seat, and in the caboose, or the big minority and big labor, and B, as long as a significant percentage of the Euro-American working class continues to vote for the right, it seems to me that will forever be the case. Now, what's happened in the United States in recent decades, particularly since immigration reform in 1965, is that the ranks of the Democratic Party have been replenished by a surge of Latino votes in particular and Asian American votes. As you probably know, in California, the Asian Pacific population is much larger than the Black American population. And of course, perhaps at this point in August 2016, the plurality of the population of the state of California is Latino, with those defined as white probably in a minority. And so that's helped to replenish the Democratic Party and also has led to this anomaly where it seems for some time to come the Democrats will be controlling the White House, but because of gerrymandering and the way districts are drawn, that the Republicans with their white base will probably continue to control the House. The Senate is another story that could go either way. But the House has the power of the purse. They're the ones who dictate how money is spent, which means that the white right has their tight fists ensnared in the power of the purse. And as long as that's the case, it's going to be difficult to get the kind of spending priorities that we need in this country. So to circle back to your initial inquiry, I think that ultimately there's going to have to be a shakeout in the House. Now, I've understood that Paul Ryan, the Speaker, the Republican Speaker, is very much concerned about maintaining his majority in the House, although most polls tend to suggest that in 2016, even with the blowout of Trump, the Republicans will continue to control the House. That can change before the first Tuesday in November. But in any case, at some point, we have to begin the long march of transformation. And that long march of transformation not only has to take place within the ranks of the Democratic Party, it not only will involve helping to engineer a split in the Republican Party, which hopefully is well underway, but it also has to involve building a third force. And I think that's what the Greens are trying to do. And as I said, it's very difficult because there's a problem of funding, it's a problem of finance, it's a problem of being harassed even by people on the left who are supposed to be your friends or at least not your antagonists. And so it's going to be a very difficult journey, but I think in order to avoid worst-case scenario, World War III, we don't have an alternative.
Do you think... I'm speaking again to you as a historian. We are in an evolving moment here in history. Do you think that part of what the challenge for the Green Party is finding its own way and redefining itself, not on the basis of ideological commitment and conviction, but squaring that against political pragmatism? There are things that have to be done that may contradict your ideals. It comes to like funding, where you get your funding, how you get your program done, how do you beef up your capacity, your membership, so that you can get into Congress and begin to do some serious business. These are some of the pragmatic challenges for a party, but I'm not suggesting they shouldn't and can't achieve that, but I'm saying why isn't that part of the public discussion, that the party, yes, it has to have ideals, but it has to also communicate that it is dealing with some really serious pragmatic challenges, and it's a growth process. So idealism is a very important thing. People have to have hope. People have to have a sense of achievement, something being achieved and in the process of going somewhere. But I get the sense, just the same, from the Green Party and other parties, including the Democratic Party, that there is this emphasis on so much idealism that it almost negates the reality of what has to be done in this moment.
What do you mean by idealism?
Well, when you say things like we are going to basically, let's take the issue of education. We're going to just wipe out educational costs for college without explaining, in order to achieve that, what we have to do. In order to provide free medical care, what we have to do, what we have to be prepared to fight for. Simply saying it. And I don't disagree at all with these planks, but I'm saying that part of the responsibility is to re-educate the public about what is important to consider as we move on these planks. It's a fight, and it's not about being idealistic. It's about being realistic. And I find that, you know, very often there's way too much idealism and not enough realism.
Well, I mean, I think if you look at free higher education, for example, that was something that was touted by Senator Bernie Sanders. But yet, at the end of the day, it was something that has been touted by Secretary Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Right.
That is to say that at certain moments, what seems like idealism can even be adopted by a centrist as being realistic, or a center-rightist, if you like, speaking of Secretary Clinton. And I see the same thing with regard to Medicare for All. I mean, it's obvious that there are certain problems with Obamacare, despite studies that suggest that it's improved the health of countless numbers of U.S. nationals, particularly in states where it's received the most resistance. I'm thinking of places like Arkansas and Kentucky, for example, that despite those successes and victories, there are problems. And at the end of the day, it might seem that Medicare for All is a way to bail out Obamacare, is a way to bail out the health care needs of 100% of the U.S. citizenry. And so I think that if you look at historical analogies, at one time it might have seemed that abolishing slavery was some sort of blue sky proposal. Certainly in 1820 it would have seemed that way. And certainly in 1800 argument would have been, well, let's just try to abolish the slave trade first, bringing people from Africa, and we'll talk about abolishing the slave trade later. And even in 1800, abolishing the slave trade seemed beyond the pale. But what you needed, if I may steal your term, is a bunch of idealists who were not deterred or detained, and who pushed selflessly on behalf of what seemed to be an idealistic goal. And at the end of the day, they won the argument. And so that's, I hope I'm not putting too much of a burden on the shoulders of the Green Party to put them in the same league as abolitionists. In some ways, they are, because we always need a core, or we historically have needed a core of individuals, a group, who were, if you like, vanguard forces, who were trailblazing forces, who were at the front of the march, and who put forward demands that at the moment seemed to be unrealistic, but ultimately came to be seen as common sense. And I think that's how I would look at demands for Medicare for All. That's how I would look at demands for free higher education. keep in mind that at one time, free education, K through 12, was something that was seen as idealistic. And by the way, to show you how we may be making a great leap backwards sooner rather than later, K through 12 education now is under severe challenge by this charter school phenomenon. And by the way, not only that, but to engage in a kind of disclosure, Senator Clinton and her spouse, William J. Clinton, are involved in this enterprise that might be called Charter Schools Move Into Higher Education. It's called Laureate, the Laureate Enterprise.
Yeah, we did a big program on Laureate, exposing that as part of the massive fraud that the Clinton Foundation actually is.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, Senator Clinton understandably and justifiably has criticized Trump University as a fraud, but my understanding is that Mr. Trump and his sycophants only got about $5 million from Trump University. So far, in recent years, the Clintons have gotten about $20 million from this Laureate Enterprise. As a matter of fact, these rather unseemly connections between the Clinton Foundation and then Secretary Clinton as Secretary of State really needs to be exposed. I mean, I would hope that Jill Stein puts the spotlight on this, because hopefully it will deter her from going down that road further, assuming she's elected president in November, which right now seems likely, because it's apparent that she was using her high office in order to benefit this foundation. And it all came to a kind of a sickening conclusion in Haiti. Poor Haiti.
Oh, we've been on this aspect. We have been saying here on this program for a long time now, if you really want to understand the shenanigans of the Clintons, you start with Haiti. And once you start with Haiti, you get all the other tentacles. I want to ask a question about the obvious need and perhaps a lost opportunity here from a historical point of view of a coming together between Sanders and the Green Party. What could you advance as a reason that Sanders even now is resisting what would have seemed to him, I think, based on what his views were, it would have seemed to him to be a logical choice to join forces and use this huge pool of people, he got 13 million plus votes, as a wonderful place to start this independent movement. What could his reasoning be for not accepting this opportunity to join forces with the Green Party?
Well, I understand his reasoning. At least I think I understand his reasoning. What I mean is that Senator Sanders now has gone back to his independent status on Capitol Hill, but he's still caucusing with the Democrats. And what comes to my mind immediately is a meeting that took place just before the Democratic Party convention in Philadelphia, and just before Senator Sanders fully endorsed Secretary Clinton for president. And he was being harassed at a meeting by liberal Democrats, progressive Democrats, including members of the Congressional Black Caucus, people saying, you know, you're out to lunch, you know, would you endorse Senator Clinton right now? And I assume that Senator Sanders feels that if he were to embark on the independent path, that the kinds of positions that he has on Capitol Hill as ranking member, caucusing with the Democrats, ranking member with regard to veterans, for example, which brings a certain kind of staff and certain kinds of other perks that he feels could be used on behalf of his constituency, that he might be purged from caucusing with the Democrats. And he might feel that this would be to the detriment of, say, veterans and other constituencies that he cares about. So I understand his reasoning, and I think it has to go beyond of one man. I mean, for example, who were these CBC members who were harassing Senator Sanders at this meeting? Well, we know it wasn't Keith Ellison of Minnesota, because he's one of the staunchest supporters of Bernie Sanders. But we can easily surmise that it might have been somebody like John Lewis, for example, of Georgia, and William Lacey Clay of St. Louis. I mean, we can go down the list. Why aren't constituencies pressuring them? Or, for example, Javier Becerra of Los Angeles, or, for example, members of the caucus, the Progressive Caucus from New York, and other, Nancy Pelosi, for example, the speaker, the former speaker. So, I mean, I think it just can't be all on Senator Sanders, it seems to me, because that's too much weight to put on the shoulders of one man.
Is there a possibility that it could still happen? Does he have, in any way, in your view, something up his sleeve?
Well, I tend to doubt it. I think in order for politicians or pragmatists, and you don't get elected as a self-proclaimed democratic socialist, even from Vermont, without having a streak of pragmatism within you. And it seems to me that the Greens would have to show that they were at least breaking through the 5% threshold. Now, if that's, I have a sneaking suspicion that the press, which I think it's fair to say, at least in the mainstream press, New York Times, the Washington Post in particular, have turned against Donald J. Trump. I think it's not unfair to suggest. Look at the column by Tom Friedman in this morning's New York Times, where he says Trump's children should repudiate him. I mean, that's really going out on a limb. And so it seems to me that the press might start boosting Gary Johnson, the libertarian, and his running mate, William Well, the former governor of Massachusetts. And once they start boosting Gary Johnson, from their point of view, this will be a way to pull votes away from Donald J. Trump. Although I think if you look at the libertarian voters, I think it's a wash. I think that, generally speaking, it's assumed that 50% of libertarians might have voted for Clinton and 50% might have voted for Trump. But in any case, if they start boosting Gary Johnson to try to get him past the 15% threshold so he can participate in the debates, it seems to me that hopefully and indirectly might provide a boost for Jill Stein, even though, of course, they just lost the case where they tried to force their way onto the debate stage. But if Jill Stein is able to get onto the debate stage, and if it's shown that the Greens are going beyond the 5% threshold, and if it's shown that the Greens can mobilize masses, well, a politically pragmatic politician, a pragmatic politician would have to pay attention to that, and that would include Bernie Sanders.
Well, let's kind of sum up here. From your perspective, what should people be prepared for in the immediate future as this campaign proceeds? What should we be looking at and looking for?
Well, let me make a special appeal to voters in swing states, North Carolina, Florida, Ohio, perhaps Colorado, perhaps New Mexico, and a few others, to pay close attention to what's going on in your state. And if it seems likely by the first Monday in November that in those states that Secretary Clinton has a 5 to 6 point lead in the polls with regard to her chief opponent, Donald J. Trump, that you consider casting your vote for the Greens. Now, I would say that that goes in spades for those in the 40-plus states where we already know who the winner is going to be. Because I think that we're at a very perilous moment right now. As I said a few moments ago, there is a lot of hysteria growing in elite circles about the rise of China, about the inability to bring Moscow to heel. And there's a lot of loose talk, believe it or not, about war, even though it would inevitably become a nuclear war. And even though this would be terribly bad for business, as Senator Elizabeth Warren has said, it is not beyond the level of contemplation, given the fact, once again, that the ruling elite feels pressed because of the rise of China, and also because our constituencies, and the labor movement and the big minority in particular, are not up to speed on foreign policy. So this is a very perilous moment, and so we may have to make some risky decisions. But making a risky decision at the ballot box is a far cry from what we might face in a worst-case scenario.
Well, I want to thank you, Gerald, for being with us. You always bring such extraordinary clarity and light on very complex issues, and you force us to rethink our position all the time because you bring a wealth of information. As a historian, you give us a context. And as a candidate yourself, you give us news from the inside of this beast, which you have had to deal with for quite a while. Let me ask, what's next for you as you prepare your next book? What's your next book?
Well, before I do that, are we going to have time to talk about the South African elections?
I don't think we have too much time. So, in fact, this gives me the opportunity to say to you, I've been getting so many requests. People just want to talk to you. So is there a way that we can talk a little bit later about scheduling you just to do that and basically do a classroom instruction and be available for just for questions?
Sure, anytime. But okay. With regard to the book, I have a book coming out, two, maybe three books coming out next year. One is Pan-Africanism is the News, Claude Burnett, the Associated Negro Press, and the Paradox of Jim Crow. It tells the story of this Associated Negro Press, a black version of the Associated Press. It had reporters and journalists all over the world, although it was an entrepreneurial venture. And as Jim Crow began to recede, paradoxically enough, the Associated Negro Press began to collapse because, of course, the mainstream press began to steal all of its journalists, such as Charlene Hunter Galt, who defected to the New York Times, and C. Gerald Fraser, the late C. Gerald Fraser, who defected to the New York Times, et cetera. There are other books, too, and when I have more time, I'm sure I can have an opportunity
to discuss. We'll talk with each other shortly, and we'll schedule your next appearance, in which people will have you all to themselves and they can field the questions. And I thank you so much for being with us again today. Very illuminating. Thanks.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of our program. I hope it was informative. I certainly believe it was. You can reach me at Lead Stories, LEIDstories@gmail.com. Stay tuned. Coming up next, NDC Savings Club. And you can definitely join me again tomorrow for more programming. We'll talk about the Green Party all week. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.